Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's episode. Today we have Carl Allen on the show. How are you doing today, Carl?
I'm good, Kirk. Thanks for having me.
Good, good. Well, we've been looking to fill this void in our interviews lately because we've been trying to find someone to talk about M&A with companies. We have a lot of people who are real estate investors. We bring in people to talk about how to acquire real estate. We don't really talk about companies. And I think that's a huge asset class that goes overlooked by way too many people. So, Carl, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background?
I've been a deal maker for just over 28 years. So I started my career in 92. I went to work for an investment bank on Wall Street. So I was buying and selling businesses on behalf of some really large corporates like GE and Boeing and IBM and Microsoft and those kind of guys. And then I did that right the way through till the early 2000s, decided to go and get my MBA. So I went to the University of Chicago, then worked in private equity in Boston for a while. And we ended up selling one of our portfolio companies to Hewlett-Packard. And I went along with the deal and became one of Hewlett-Packard's M&A directors, trawling the globe, you know, buying businesses, some of them in the billions of dollars. So I was doing all that until 2008. It was the 1st of February 2008. My life completely changed in a day. I was in a boardroom in Moscow closing on a deal for HP, and my wife called me from the UK, and she'd gone into labor. She was 4 weeks premature with the birth of our son, Josh, who's now 12. So I literally had to run out of the boardroom. Luckily, I had my passport and my phone and my wallet. I didn't take my luggage. I think it's still there. I hailed a cab, got to the airport, managed to fly home. I got to the hospital literally minutes before my son was born. So my son was born 1st of February 2008 in the UK, and I'm cradling the little guy in my arms. And I thought, I just don't want to do this anymore. I want to be with my family. So I retired. I quit HP. I walked away from $1 million worth of bonuses and stock options, but I didn't really care. I wanted to be with my family. And that lasted about 3 weeks. I got really bored and frustrated, having been 100 miles an hour to zero. So I decided to get back into the game. I remember sitting down with my wife one night and saying, you know, what am I going to do for the rest of my career? She said, well, you only know how to buy and sell companies. You're one of the best in the world at it. So that's what you've still got to do. So I became a business broker. So I started myself up as a business broker. I found a business to sell. But in the end, I ended up acquiring that business myself. I used all of my Wall Street training in the concept of leveraged buyouts, which is basically buying a business using other people's money. And I used those skills to raise some capital to be able to acquire the transport company that I was supposed to be selling. And that took me on a kind of journey of buying up, growing, and then selling businesses, which I still do today. I own a private equity firm in the US on the East Coast, and we're very active in acquiring small businesses between $1 and $10 million in revenues. And then over the past 4 years, I've also become a coach in this world. So I today coach and mentor over 5,000 entrepreneurs and business owners that want to acquire companies as an alternative asset class. I get to eat my own cooking, which is great. So I coach on this stuff, but I also do this stuff as well. And I typically split my time 50-50.
When you look at your history of acquiring big companies, and now you're doing the same thing for smaller companies, what's really kind of the difference between, you know, M&A work with bigger and smaller companies?
So that's a really good question. And it's a really simple answer. And the answer is psychology, seller psychology. When you're doing billion-dollar deals, and I've done tons of those in my corporate life, those deals are more about financial engineering. So if you're HP, your stock price is trading at 30 times earnings, and you find a business that wants to sell for 20 times earnings, it's a really easy deal to structure because you're giving the seller shares in HP and you're arbitraging that multiple instantly. Because as soon as the profit of the acquisition hits your bottom line, the stock market's grossing it up to whatever HP's trading at. So Big deals are all about financial engineering. Small deals are all about psychology. Because when you look at the seller, so the market data is pretty amazing. There's 2.4 million businesses for sale right now in the United States, between $1 and $10 million in revenues. And only about 1 in 11 of those businesses will actually sell. And one of the reasons is that buyers don't appreciate the psychology involved with the seller. So there's a couple of things. The first thing is buyers automatically assume sellers know what they're doing when it comes to selling a business. They don't. Most of them have likely never been through the process before. They might have advisors on board, like a broker, like a CPA, like an attorney, but emotionally and psychologically, they're going through a roller coaster journey that they're just not prepared for. So understanding the seller's psychology and what they truly want in a deal is one of the most important skills to master. Most people think sellers just want money, and it's not true. Most sellers, especially baby boomers, they want some money, of course, but they're not looking to sell to the highest bidder because they cherish and value the legacy and the business that they built. You know, they've probably spent more time in that business over the past, say, 20 years than they have with their own family. And when they decide to sell because they want to retire or they're burnt out or they've just run out of ideas, whatever the reason is, they want a safe, trusted pair of hands that really understands them, really understands the business, really understands the market, and how they will add value to that business and grow it as the new owner. That's what the vast majority of sellers are looking for. So awful lot of my coaching and mentoring really kind of drills into that concept. And yeah, people need to understand numbers. People need to understand balance sheets and term sheets and negotiation and where to find deals, deal origination, and all that good stuff. But that's the easy part. Anyone can do that. The challenge is really understanding psychologically and emotionally what the seller's going through and what they truly want out of a deal. Once you nail that, pretty simple process.
Interesting. I mean, I guess it's not much different from the public markets, just on a much larger scale, you know, when you're talking about buying and selling stocks on the exchange. I find it fascinating that money is not really as big of a deal as you would normally think for most people selling a business. Can you talk a little bit about what a private equity firm is and how that's different from, say, like a venture capital firm or some other types? Because I think it's important to understand the distinction.
So private equity and venture capital are technically the same. Same with angel investing. So private equity is just an asset class where my partner and I, we're investing our own money into other people's deals. So venture capital is more kind of mid-stage growth businesses. It's a lot more prevalent in, say, the technology industry or the pharmaceutical industry. Angel investing, these are high net worth individuals that have real skills and chops in a particular industry, and they'll invest some of their money to help businesses grow and succeed. Private equity traditionally was more for very large deals, buyout deals. So KKR, for example, Henry Kravis's PE firm, you know, they closed one of the largest leverage buyout deals in history when they wrote a $25 billion check to acquire RGR Nabisco in 1987. They did that deal using other people's money. So what we're doing is taking the concept of a leverage buyout from Wall Street and applying it into Main Street type of businesses. But private equity is essentially people with cash investing in other people's deals, either to grow businesses or, in our case, to actually acquire them.
How does somebody do that? If I was going to go out and buy a business and wanted to do that, how does that work?
Let's say you found a company. Let's say the purchase price of that company was $1 million. You can finance that deal in three ways. So there are three elements typically to any acquisition. The first is seller financing. So seller financing is where if you're paying $1 million for the business, the seller's not getting the full $1 million at closing, like they would with a piece of real estate. They're getting some, or in some cases, all of that money over time. I bought a media agency in California a couple of years ago, and I bought that business without raising any financing whatsoever, equity or debt. I was able to buy that business and just pay the seller a chunk of money every month for a predetermined amount of time. Because a lot of sellers, they get to the point where they want to retire, but they don't have the, you know, they don't have the net worth to retire comfortably. They need the cash flow that the business is giving them, so they can't afford to leave the business, but they want to. They're highly motivated to want to sell. So you can buy someone's business, not all cases, but in some cases, by just agreeing a deal, obviously paying them slightly more, but paying them over time and then giving them security over the business. So if you don't pay them the money, they can just come and take it back. So seller financing is one element of the deal structure. And you can even kind of juice that up by including something called an earnout, which gives the seller bonus payments based on, you know, really high financial performance. So if you bought a business and you grew it so it was a lot more profitable, the seller could even make more money from the sale over time because they're sharing in some of that upside. The other element that goes into these deals is debt-based financing. So you can go to a financier like a bank or a specialist, and you can raise capital against real estate, fixed assets, inventory, intellectual property, even the receivables in the business. You can get AR financing. So that's a class of assets that allows you to raise funding to go into deals. Another massive financier of deals is the SBA and the SBA 7A loan. So what the SBA will do is they will provide between 75 and 90% of the purchase price as a loan, which is then paid back over 10 years and in some cases longer. They're financing business purchases a bit like you would finance real estate. And then the third piece is equity. So you might need to put some cash into the deal. So if you've got some cash, let's say you're doing a deal and you need 10%. It's a $1 million deal. You've got a $900,000 loan from the SBA and you need 10% of cash. Sometimes you can split that with the seller, but let's say you've got to pay all that yourself. You just need $100,000 in cash to buy a business worth $1 million. So if you've got that money, you can put it in. Or if you don't, you can go and partner with somebody. So you can go and partner with an angel investor, say, who will give you that $100,000 for a minority ownership in the business so you can buy it. And then you've got an angel investor on your board that's going to have skills and experiences in your industry and then can add a lot of value to the business once you bought it. So that's typically when you do a deal, you're financing it through a mix of those three things. So seller financing, equity, and primarily debt financing, which can come from the SBA or pretty much every other bank and financial institution in the US.
Interesting. I've been always curious of the different ways that people go acquire small businesses, and I'm sure there's a lot of other creative ways people come up with.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that comes to mind, because I've been through this a few times with some clients, you know, how do you evaluate what the business is worth? Because there's multiple different ways to evaluate it. And, you know, everyone's got their opinion. And I'm sure with small businesses, it's even more emotional or psychological, as you say. So how do you evaluate a business, or how should people look at that?
I'm going to answer it in kind of two ways. There's a qualitative answer and there's a quantitative answer. So on a qualitative answer, forget valuation for a second. It's really important that you're buying the right businesses. The best piece of advice I can give anybody that wants to buy a company is buy something in your lane. So buy something in a sector that you know something about, you're passionate about, and you can add some value to. So if you're a sales guy for IBM or, you know, Dell, go buy an IT services company. You know, don't buy a laundromat or a gas station or a vineyard. You know, buy something that you know something about, because it's a relationship business in a lot of ways. So you're building relationships with sellers, you're building relationships with financiers. You know, they all want to back you. So if you're from the industry and you know a lot about it, just makes the process a lot easier. And then once you've bought that business, you're going to know what to do to grow it, scale it, optimize it, and then eventually sell it. So that's really important. When it comes to valuation, how you value a business is one of the oldest questions in this industry. For public companies, it's a lot easier because public companies trade on a very liquid stock market. So, you know, if you want to buy Amazon, it would cost you about $1.6 trillion. Amazon's trading at about 120 times its earnings. You know, Apple's valued at just under $2 trillion. That's trading at about 35 times its earnings. Small businesses, however, in kind of the $1 to $10 million range, they're typically trading between a 2x and a 5 times multiple. So there are things that increase multiples. One is growth. If you're a really fast-growing company, your multiples go up. If you've got really high margins, your multiples go up. If you've got lots of intellectual property in your business or kind of high barriers to entry, if you've got world-class systems and processes and people, those are all things that elevate multiples, you know, at 5 times or sometimes even higher. But the vast majority of small businesses tend to trade in the kind of 2 to 4 range and more in the 2 to 3 range. And a lot of the business brokers out there like Transworld, BizBuySell.com, you know, brokers are one way of originating deals. They publish their quarterly statistics. I think currently in the US, the average for a small business is about 2.54 times its profit. That's what businesses are worth. Now, sometimes sellers, you know, all mamas love the babies, don't they? Sometimes a seller will think their business is worth considerably more. And there's ways you can overcome that, again, by structuring the deal. So let's say you think the business is worth a 3 times multiple and the seller won't sell for anything less than a 5 times multiple. You can still pay 5 times for that business, but just put more of the deal into that seller financing. So you're just paying for the business over a longer period of time. You know, it's not about the valuation. It's more about the structure of the deal and how the seller's actually going to get the money.
That's a good point. It kind of comes back to this. We talk about it in real estate all the time, price versus terms, right? Do you want the price or do you want the terms? You pick one, I'll pick the other. It has to work out for both the buyer and the seller. So yeah. What criteria do you look for in a business when you're trying to choose a business?
I start off with a simple three-legged stool. Any business that I look at has really got to tick 3 boxes. So the first thing is it's got to be, and this isn't just for me, this is what I advise my thousands of students. The first thing, and we've talked about it briefly, is buy a business in your lane. Buy a business that strategically is going to make sense for you. So again, if you're an IBM sales guy and you want to leave the corporate world, go buy a technology business. You know, don't buy a laundromat. You know, if you own, say, a landscaping company and you want to grow that business by acquisition, don't go and buy a vineyard. Go and buy either another landscaping company or go and buy the company that supplies you with all the fertilizer, or go buy a hardscaping company or something that's got some real synergy with what you're already doing. So buying in your space is point number one. Point number two is typically for me, I want to buy a good business from a distressed seller, not the other way around. You'll find plenty of distressed businesses owned by good sellers who think their businesses are worth a lot of money. So what I'm looking for is a business that's profitable, just generating cash flow. At the very least, revenues are flat, doesn't necessarily need to be growing, but I don't want a business that's declining and is in some sort of trouble. I want a business that's got sustainability. I'm looking for businesses that, and you might find this really crazy, the perfect business for me is one that doesn't do any marketing. And that's like 80% of the businesses that I see. I was on a call, probably spoke to 5 different sellers today on deals. And the first call I had, which was lunchtime for me, morning in the US, I said to the seller, you know, what's your marketing strategy? And he said, you know what, Carl? This is what's so great about our business. We don't do any marketing. We don't have to do any marketing. All of our business comes from repeat buyers and word of mouth referrals. So I absolutely love those businesses because it tells me if they've got a loyal customer base that keeps coming back and buying from them, then they're obviously doing something right to the point where they're even referring people to buy from that business as well. I love those businesses because when I get in there and me and my team, we implement our marketing tactics, we know we're going to radically be able to scale that business over and above that really solid base that it's already built. And then onto the numbers then, the third point that I'm always looking for is I want a business that's either got strong cash flow or assets or ideally both, because that gives me the rocket fuel to go and raise capital to be able to buy that business using other people's money. So those are my 3 key criteria. And two and three are generic for everybody. But number one, a perfect business for me, Kirk, could be a completely different business for you. It's all about buying something that you know, you understand, you're passionate about, and you can really add some value to.
So when you say strong cash flow, can you help quantify that a little bit? Because, you know, we hear that a lot, but what does that mean in relative to other things, like relative to public stocks, relative to real estate? What does strong cash flow mean to you?
So strong cash flow is from the start of a year to the end of a year, does the business generate cash? Profitability is irrelevant because a business can be profitable on its income statement, but it's not generating any cash flow because it's spending its cash flow on working capital to continue to grow the business or keep reinvesting or paying down debt or whatever it's doing. So for me, year on year, I need to see a business positively generating cash, either from its operations or from its investing or from its financing. Really, really important, because that cash flow is the fuel that I'm going to use to be able to access capital to buy that company.
So just to clear up the point, say cash flow, you made it sound like it's revenue. You said not profits, though.
Let's say you own a business and it generates $1 million per year in revenues. And let's say that business has got an $800,000 per year cost base, cost of sales or overhead. So that business in that year has now generated $200,000 of profit. But profit is not cash. So that business has got $200,000. If it's had to spend $200,000 in working capital to generate that revenue, then its cash flow year on year is zero. It's made $200,000 from its operations, but it's had to spend that to invest in the business, pay down debt, acquire more inventory, all those different things. So I want a business that at the end of the year, there is cash sticking to the fingers of that business.
You had mentioned another point that, you know, you're acquiring multiple companies. We're a little going off track with this, but I think it's an important point. If you're acquiring one company, you're a business owner, but if you're acquiring multiple companies, you're an investor. When you're buying companies, how do you leverage that so you don't have to be wearing 10 different hats and be at 10 places at once?
So that's a really good question. And again, that's how private equity works. You know, even for an individual that doesn't own a private equity firm and wants to buy a bunch of businesses, there's a massive difference between being an owner investor and being an owner manager. And there's no harm in being an owner manager. I'm mentoring thousands of students that they want to leave the corporate world and want to become business owners, buying versus starting. And they are thrilled at being able to go into that business every day and operationally run that business. So they're involved in, you know, a lot of the tactical work and the decisions that they need to make to keep that business going. However, there are equally the same number of students that I mentor that don't want to operate the businesses. They want to buy them as owner investors. And for that, you need a partner or a GM, a general manager that will basically run that business for you and report to you. And then you're effectively remote managing that business through KPIs and other dashboards of performance. And those GMs can come from anywhere. They can come from people that you know before you buy the business. So you might be really good at doing the deal and the strategic work and maybe some of the financial work, but you're not strong on the operational skills to run, say, a manufacturing business. Then, you know, just go and partner with somebody that can't do what you can do, or doesn't want to learn, just wants to go in and drive that bus, so to speak, that's my metaphor, then partner with them and you can give them some of the equity in that business. And then they're your partner. They're a vested partner that will work alongside you and do all of that daily, you know, tactical work, working in the business versus you working, you know, on the business as that investor. So it's a bit like being the chairman of a company. You're just remote monitoring, you know, what's going on. And that's what I do in all of the businesses that I own. You know, I'm not active in any of them. I've got management teams that are running those businesses. I have a big part to play in the strategic vision for the business. My team sets up all the performance monitoring dashboards. So I can tell you right now what the revenue, profit, and cash flows are in any of my businesses, how many new customers we even acquired, at what cost, and how my businesses are forecasted to look. But I'm not in there every day driving those businesses forward. I've got people that do that. And GMs, you can find them on LinkedIn. And in a lot of cases, they can be really solid number twos in the businesses already. Oftentimes, I'll speak to a seller, and it's one of my first questions is, you know, do you have a solid number two in your business? And most of the times they do. And I actually say to them, well, why don't you sell it to that person? And they say, well, he doesn't want to buy it, or she doesn't want to buy it. They're happy running the business, but they don't want the responsibility of becoming the business owner. And I get that, because some people just aren't wired to be business owners. They're happy to be general managers and work in businesses for other people. So a lot of the GMs I have, or I've had in the past, have already been in the business. Sometimes the owner has run the business for me, at least part-time, till I've found a permanent solution to that. So that's the big difference. And that's one of the first questions I have my students answer in their mind. You know, the question is, do you want to be an owner manager, or do you want to be an owner investor? And there's no right or wrong answer. It depends on who you are and how you're wired. Some people, they want to buy businesses all over the world and have a portfolio. Then obviously you've got to be an owner investor. But if you're really passionate about something, you know, if you're a web designer working for a large corporate and you want your own show and you want to be in there every day driving that forward, there's absolutely no reason why you can't buy that business and be the owner operator.
It sounds like you're just acquiring companies and you're running the show. But have you ever invested in an owner where the owner may just need additional capital to grow and you just kind of let them run it, but you just acquire a big stake in it?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's very, very common. Sometimes, though, in fact, more times than not, I'm doing that not for capital. I'm doing that for my strategic value that I can bring to that business. And that's called consulting for equity. So often someone will approach me, they say they want my money, but in reality, what they want is my brain and my network. And I'm able to save them so much money inside of that business already that they actually don't need the capital to start with. So I'll get my equity in that business for free. In some cases, I'll angel invest in a business. I'll put hard dollars in, providing, of course, there's a very, very specific reason why they want that money. And generally for me, it's marketing. I won't give people money so they can cash out unless I'm buying the whole business. If people want to grow and want to partner with me, then the money I'll put in will typically be for marketing, because that's one of my superpowers. I can grow any business anywhere in the world. It just needs brains and money. And that's what I do best. So people that want my capital to scale, get them to call me.
What's kind of, when you say you're good at marketing, how do you kind of look at that piece?
One of the really interesting things about the business world today is how reluctant a lot of traditional businesses are to digital marketing. It really amazes me that the average kind of brick and mortar traditional US business, sub $10 million in revenues, you know, doesn't do marketing. They don't employ any digital resources. They're not using Google. They're not using Facebook. They're not using YouTube as a way to reach more customers. A lot of the case, they're very inbound. So they're very reactive. They put a website up. They don't do any SEO. And they're just hoping and praying customers call them. They're not proactively going out there generating leads and then having salespeople proactively follow up and convert those leads into customers. I've turned that really into a science. You know, through my 28 years, having seen and worked with probably more than 10,000 businesses, I've really seen some best-in-class approaches to both marketing, which is about awareness and generating lead flow, and also conversion, because it's great to have 1,000 leads. If you don't convert them into paying customers and then repeat paying customers, then, you know, there's something wrong. So that's a big part of the value that I bring when I buy a business. And of course, all this stuff I teach as part of my coaching program.
When you're looking at acquiring businesses, are you buying them for permanence, or do you have an exit strategy? Or
there's typically two ways. I'm not into what is now a fashionable term called business flipping. So I'm not somebody that will go and acquire a business, own it for a couple of weeks, and then sell. You know, for me, it's all about adding value. So typically, I'll own a business for an average about 3 years. that gives me enough time to really make my mark on that business and to deploy my skills and the skills of my team and really move the needle. Because when you think about it, there's lots of different reasons why people do this. A lot of different reasons why people become business buyers. Because at the end of the day, nobody wants to buy a business. Nobody wants to own a business. What we want as human beings are the benefits that flow from becoming a business owner. And that could be wealth, it could be freedom, it could be legacy, it could be pride, it could be assurance. You know, all these people are getting furloughed and laid off through coronavirus. You know, when you're a business owner, you're more in control of your own destiny, unless you own an airline, of course, or a cruise ship company. So there's different reasons. And obviously, you know, wealth is a big part of it for most people. You know, they're frustrated and tired of working for other people and just collecting a paycheck. They're not getting any upside because they have no skin in the game. All their work and effort is making somebody else wealthy. So that drives a lot of people to get into this market. And when you think about it economically, there's three ways that you make money doing these deals. Sometimes you raise more capital on the deal than you actually need to pay out at the time of closing. So that gives you a little kind of piece of money that if you want to, you can take out of the business right at the start. Then obviously as the business owner, once you've whatever cash flow the business generates, once you've paid the money to service the deal, so you've made those seller financing payments, you've paid the interest and the capital back in that period on the external financing that you've raised, then whatever cash is left, then that's your money. You own the business. You own the cash flow. So you can do whatever you want with that. But the biggest payday in these types of deals is when you buy a business, you grow it, and then you sell it. Bearing in mind, you're growing the business over a period where you're paying down the debt that you've had to take on to buy it. It's like buying a rundown house on a 100% mortgage, really kind of sprucing it up and making it truly appealing, selling it for double the money, but in the time period, you've paid off half the financing. So 75% of the selling price you're going to put into your bank account. That's really important to bear in mind.
I've heard this from many people, and depending on the business, everyone's got different perspectives. But there's this concept of growing a business organically versus through acquisitions. Some businesses, especially larger businesses, do a lot of acquisitions. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because the organic part seems to be a lot harder, but it depends on, I guess, the size of the company as well.
Any business, really, doesn't matter what it is. There's only three ways you can grow it. You can grow it organically, as you've said. You can grow it through having joint ventures and other partners. So if you're an online digital company, you have a list of customers and a list of products, you can go and partner with somebody else that has a different list and a different set of products, and then you can cross-pollinate the products and the services between all those customers and share in the upside. Or you can do that better by acquisition. So if you own, say, a software company, and you're selling software, you can go and buy, say, an IT services company, and then you can sell the IT services you just acquired to all your existing software customers. You can then sell the software that you originally had to all those new IT services customers. So it's like a 1 + 1 = 3 on the revenue side. And then, of course, when you combine two businesses together, there are fantastic economies of scale and savings in overhead. So your profitability then increases more actually than your revenues. And as you've said, this is what the big guys do. This is what, you know, Cisco were one of the largest, most aggressive companies in this market. They just grew purely by acquisition. You know, same with HP, who I used to work for. We bought tons and tons and tons of businesses. Same with IBM, same with Microsoft. GE's made loads of acquisitions. There's kind of three reasons why companies acquire other companies. You know, one is just to double down in your current niche. So, you know, if you're a software company, you know, go and buy a competitor and then, you know, you own double the market share. Or you can go and buy somebody in your supply chain. So, for example, if you're a landscaping company and half of your cost is spent on fertilizer, go buy the fertilizer company and then you're capturing all of that profit back into your business. But one of the most common ways of growing through acquisition is where you buy in complementary markets which have synergy. So again, a landscaping company might go and buy, say, a hardscaping company, or a software company might go and buy an IT services company. Or you want to enter a market super fast and you don't have the skills. So that's why Facebook bought WhatsApp. That's why Amazon bought Audible. These are the reasons why, if you want to fly in a market and you don't have the resources or the time to build it yourself, it's quicker and cheaper to actually go and acquire somebody. And if you're a public company, it's really easy because, you know, you've got a share price with a high multiple, which gives you, you know, rocket fuel to use to do that deal.
Lastly, as we kind of wrap up here, what are some of the biggest mistakes people make in making acquisitions when they're acquiring a business?
So on the small scale, which is obviously where my focus is these days, you know, there's tons and tons of mistakes people make when they're buying public companies, but I don't think it's relevant for this conversation. But for small deals, the most biggest mistake that people make, and I've alluded to it a couple of times, is they don't buy in their space. They don't buy in their lane. They think, I can just go and buy any business. And it's really, really hard. I have one student at the moment. I keep mentioning the IBM sales guy. He's an IBM sales guy. You know, I said to him, go buy an IT services company. There's millions of them around. And he said, well, I don't want to do that. I want to get out of this world. You know, I want to buy a vineyard because I'm really passionate about wine. And I'm like, yeah, but you don't know anything about making wine. You know anything about the business of being a vineyard. You don't know how to grow wine. You don't know how to bottle it. You don't know how to market it. You don't know anything. He said, oh, I still want to do it. So I had to convince him, and it's took me a while, to go and partner with somebody that really understands the business of winemaking. So the biggest mistake I would say is people buy outside of their area of expertise, and that's a huge mistake. Once you've done a bunch of deals, it's a bit easier because you develop like horizontal skill sets. The second mistake is they think buying and selling businesses at this level is a lot like it is on Wall Street, and it's not. We talked about this before. This is a relationship business, and this is a game of psychology. It's not necessarily about math and numbers and term sheets and legals. It's all about relationships. The stronger the relationships that you build, the better. The third mistake a lot of people make is they will only go to business brokers to find deals. And that's a huge mistake because the best deals don't come from brokers. There are some good deals with brokers, but most of the best businesses I've ever acquired have come through building a network. When you own a business and you've decided it's time for you to sell, you tell five people. You tell your spouse, your CPA, your lawyer, your wealth manager, and your bank or financier, whoever's supporting you in that business financially. So if you're a deal maker and you want to do deals, you got to go network with four out of those five people. Obviously, forget the spouse for a minute, but you'll go and build a local network of all of those different professionals. And they're all vested to help you with a deal. You know, if you're talking to wealth managers, they'll happily refer you to clients that want to sell because they know when the client sells the business, there's going to be some funds that they want to go and then invest with that wealth manager. CPAs and lawyers will help you because they'll either get paid from the seller to transact the deal, or you'll pay them once you close the deal as the buyer. Financiers, again, they'll know owners that want to sell. And for them, they've got capital at play making the money in that deal. They might want to keep it involved and support you instead. Those, I think, are the three biggest mistakes I see people make.
I really appreciate you kind of sharing your wisdom with us. You know, it's hard to find good people to talk about this, so I really appreciate you coming on the show. Where can people find more about you?
They can go to dealmakerwealthsociety.com. That talks all about what we do, our coaching programs. They can hit up our YouTube channel of the same name. But strongest recommendation, especially if you like reading, I have a book on Amazon called No Money Down Business Buying Secrets. I think it's like $30 on Amazon. I've got a special $5 link that I'll give you, Kirk, for your audience. So for people that are interested in this, want to learn more about me and my methods and my system, they can go and read the book. It's at trainwithcarl.com/moneytree. So that's trainwithcarl.com/moneytree. The reason it's $5, it's not free, is then I know people will read it. I'm one of these people that, you know, if you give stuff away, people never consume it. I want people to consume it and learn something and make some decisions with their life, whether or not this is something that they want to do. I think $5 incentivizes you to at least read it.
So that was a great interview with Carl Allen. I really enjoyed that. It's not every day you get to talk with somebody who works with private companies. And I think it was a real treat for me because it's really kind of this secret club that you don't really hear about at all unless you're a part of it. And the people who are really good at it, they don't really talk about this part of it because they really don't want to tell the world how successful they're becoming. So I really appreciate Carl coming on the show. Now we're getting into the panel portion of the show. So we have our very own Barbara Friedberg. How you doing today, Barb?
Hi, Kirk. Doing great today. How are you?
Doing great. We also have our very own Megan Gorman. How you doing?
Hi, Kirk. How are you?
How's the smoke in your part of the world? I know it's is it getting better.
It is getting better. Barb, is it better by you?
Yes, I can actually go outside.
Just so people know, Barb and I basically straddle the Bay Area. I'm on the East Bay side. And Barb, you're over by San Jose?
Yes, but we get smoke from all angles. But fortunately, I think the fires are under control now.
Glad to hear that, because it must have been depressing when it's pretty much perpetual night. I think the vampires would have loved that, a few weeks of no sun at all. So getting into the panel portion of the show, I really want to kind of dig in here. So Megan, you work with high net worth people, and you probably come across this type of investing with private company stock a lot. What's your opinion on this kind of investing for people?
First of all, I thought it was a really interesting interview because this side of private company investing, I don't deal with a lot because most of my clients are entrepreneurs or they are corporate executives. That being said, I thought that in hearing this, it was a really good lesson for anyone as an investor. That's because Carl got into some of the bigger things that I think we deal with in looking to make a decision whether to invest. Now, he's looking at these smaller companies, but what I found interesting over the course of the interview is he talked about things like seller psychology, understanding the thinking of what the seller and the buyer are truly trying to get out of it, which I think most people don't actually think about as much as he sort of encourages you to. I think the other things that he touched on that I think are important is the ability to do due diligence and to really think about making sure that the deal makes sense, right? So he talked a lot about financing, looking at the balance sheet, and how do you actually operate in that space? And I think that those main tenets are really, really important, particularly when you're going to invest in private companies. And the last thing I'll say is I was really struck by the statistics he gave. I literally sat there listening to him writing this down, that there are 2.4 million businesses for sale right now with 1 to 10 million of revenue, and that only 1 in 11 of them sell. And that was a pretty powerful number to me. It just sort of tells you that for somebody who can really do the due diligence and understand the psychology out there and can provide financing, there's a smorgasbord of opportunity.
What's interesting is work with a lot of people who they don't really consider a business in the same way as they consider real estate. They might look at real estate and say, oh, it's great. It's a passive investment. And I'd say, well, there's no real passive investments, but you know, certainly investing in private company stock or, you know, private companies, you know, it takes a certain kind of mindset and a certain interest in doing the diligence and being involved. So I think it's a great point. Barb, what are your thoughts, you know, from the interview?
Well, I thought this was a really different guest than we typically have on. And for the right person, this presents an idea about how you can become an entrepreneur. And literally, from how he was describing how the deals were structured, you can do it without a ton of money if you are the type of person that wants to be an entrepreneur and doesn't want to start something from the ground up. And I think there may be a lot of merit in buying an already running business, because starting a business from the ground up is a tremendous amount of work. So if you're the type of person that may be working for someone else and thinks, you know, I can do this. I have the desire. I have the knowledge. I have the information. I like the complementarity that he discussed. And actually, I have a family friend who used to work for IBM, and he was in this same position. And he said, you know, I want to run my own business. So he shopped around for probably close to a year, found a business, bought that business, and built it up to a massive scale over decades. And really an example of an entrepreneur in the making. Obviously, this is not for everyone, but it's an idea of how you can craft your own work history, your work future.
And I think it's important to take away from this because it's a, you know, very different guest, as you said, Barb. If you think about the life cycle of companies, there's ground up, which takes a certain type of person because that's really hard work. And if you do it well, you can do really well, but it's hard. It's not easy to get the funding. It's not easy to start from scratch. Like all of that is really difficult. Then you have, you know, businesses that are existing. Maybe they're growing. They're not quite mature yet, but they're still in the growth stage. And then you've got mature businesses. And if you think about what the possibilities are that you can invest in, whether it's an angel investment, a venture capital investment, whether it's a mature company, maybe a little more private equity, there's so many different paths that people take. You know, I've been trying to get somebody on to talk about the concept of a search fund, which is basically in some ways similar, which is you go and you search around for a company to buy, and then you hire a CEO to run it for you, and you just get the cash flow. There's so many different paths that people could take to invest. You're not just stuck with the stock market. And I think that's really what I'm trying to convey with this is there are so many different ways to invest. There is no single right way to invest. There are many right ways to invest. What's important is what is right for you. And what you can do that matches with your investor psychology. This is not for everybody, but for the right people, this is a perfect fit, especially somebody who really want to have their own company, but they just don't want to start one. This is a way to do that. It's a great perspective to think about. And when you're investing is actually a good overlay is looking at even in the public markets, the IPO versus the old blue chips that have been around for decades. It's just another way to look at it. Megan, how can listeners take something away from this? Like, how is this applicable to most listeners in your opinion?
There's two sides to this, right? Are you a buyer or are you a seller? What I think about people who have businesses today that they're hoping to sell to someone, I would really strongly encourage them to think about this with a very, very strong tax lens. And I say this because I think when people like Carl are looking at businesses, they want to see the P&L and the balance sheets and see what the business has been doing. And a P&L, a profit and loss and a balance sheet really give you the history, the financial history of a business. And one of the big mistakes I see all the time with people with small businesses, they put lots of stuff and run them through their business. And so you really don't get a clear picture of what the business is all about. And so when they want to sell, and as he said, there's 2.4 million people, businesses today wanting to sell, the buyers are having to come in there and sort of dig through all the noise to figure out what the business is all about. Now, if you put it the other side, if you were a buyer in this, it's a pretty interesting space. And I think he brought up something interesting when he said, make sure you're buying in a space that you know. So I'll give you a really quick example. And it's a very small business, but I saw it in my neighborhood in the past 8 months, right before COVID started. But I'm a bit of a glamour girl, get my nails done every 2 weeks. And I noticed that my nail salon, which is a chain, had new owners. And I started to talk to them because they had changed the rules on some of the things in the nail salon. Things that you would notice in a nail salon. And when I asked them, I said, well, have you owned nail salons before? And they said, no, but we heard it's a good business for cash flow. So that's why we wanted to get into it. I thought that was interesting when I heard Carl talk about investing in businesses that you know, because as a customer of this business, I could tell they knew nothing about it, that they might never had walked into a nail salon before they bought this chain of them in the area. And so they were doing things and making mistakes that was going to probably cost them customers as time goes on. Now, that's just a microcosm example, but I think that that's really important, is know the space that you're looking at, because you want to be able to look at the business financials and know if you can take it to the next level.
I have to chime in on that nail salon issue because just for our listeners that are not in the Bay Area, there are literally nail salons on every corner. So the competition is so huge. And unlike most 99% of all other services in the area, the prices are unbelievably reasonable. So you can get your nails done for like, you know, a third of what I'd pay when I go to visit my family in Cincinnati. So whoever had the idea to buy nail salons in probably the most competitive nail salon area in the country, Megan, I think they made a mistake.
I'll tell you the mistake they made, because women would appreciate this. They used to let you get your manicure and pedicure at the same time, which I liked for efficiency. They wouldn't let you do that anymore. That was the change they made to the salon. So it was just causing all this chaos. And I was like, you know nothing about what you're doing here. I could have run the salon better. I feel bad for them because the salon has been closed now for 6 months. And I can only imagine how challenging it would be to have a new business because, you know, it would have been hard to get PPP and so on. But that was my quick story on small business and somebody buying something.
Yeah, I don't have much to contribute about the nail salon.
Yeah, sorry. You better stop us here because I have a feeling Megan and I could go on about the nail salon issue, and probably should stick to the theme here. But yeah. I wanted to chime in about an ancillary idea for investing in small businesses, because both from the gaining capital side and also from those individuals that might like to invest as an asset class. In other words, you don't want to actually own your own small business, but you might like to fund someone else's small business and receive a return on that. The crowdfunding sphere has cropped up as a way for you pretty much to invest in anything. And the returns vary. I just did a quick web search. There are literally at least 10 different sites, from the well-known like Kickstarter, Indiegogo, CrowdSupply, to more targeted, fundable, WeFunder, SeedInvest, Fundly, where you can buy shares in someone else's business. Returns, of course, will vary. And also, if you are a business owner, then you can seek capital from these platforms. And so this is very new in comparison with decades before, when you had to arrange all your funding yourself and find someone else to invest in. It wasn't as easy. But again, like Megan always says, do your due diligence.
That's really important. The diligence is the most important part. And it's interesting because in public companies, you can get all this information. You can get the information on all these companies, you know, can always debate whether it's accurate with all the accounting measures that they have. But the reality is they have to disclose that and it has to be accurate. With private companies, it's a lot harder, not only because it's not something you have a public filing, but also a lot of these business owners, they're not accountants. A lot of them are mom and pop investors. They're trying to do their best. They're putting food on the table. They're trying to hire employees and help them. They're doing all the things that business owners do. But a lot of them, they even combine their own personal finances with the business finances, not because they're trying to do anything tricky or weird, but because they're just trying to make it simple for themselves. So I think there's a lot of difference in the quality of business that is out there. And to one of the points it was making earlier, is there's this value add portion of it too. There's certain aspects that you could say successful businesses have these characteristics. And some of them may not have that. And having an investor that does understand how to run a business, having somebody who does know how to turn a business around, is extremely valuable. Because as Carl mentioned earlier, you could just do a handful of things and you could turn around a company pretty quick because you realize that, hey, this company's doing no marketing or they're doing a very poor job at it and they're still growing, which means that it's probably a great business And as a business owner, they're leaving money on the table or business on the table. There's a lot of aspects to this, but what it really brings in is a very different mindset than a passive investor, because this is not something that you're just going to wake up one day and say, oh, I'm just going to put a bunch of money there and hopefully it works out. That's not being a responsible investor. Barb, from your perspective, would you go out and invest in a business like this?
You know, I was just thinking about that. You must be reading my mind, because at this stage, and I have told the listeners this many times, I'm at the end third of my life, hopefully. And so I'm more of the mindset of, I want to preserve the capital that I have with modest appreciation. I'm not looking to snag those 10, 15, 20% returns and really go for the sky, because I don't have the time to make that money up. If I were younger, yes, I probably would, because there's an opportunity there that you could have a very big outsized return. So if I were, you know, probably in my 40s or, you know, kind of midlife, I would say, look, I'm going to take some of my capital. I might check out some of the crowdfunding. I might check out, actually, as long as we're on the topic, some of the real estate crowdfunding sites, some of the business crowdfunding sites. And I might see if I could really capitalize on those. Today, I'm a very, very conservative. So I pretty much stick with the public markets. And granted, all of those are not winners for sure, but my personal investing approach today is a passive index fund investment strategy, very boring across a variety of asset classes. So that's my answer, Kirk.
No, that's a great perspective. Megan, what about you? Would you invest in a company?
Oh, totally. So, you know, it's funny. I run a boutique practice and my husband is an executive. And so we run our money together. I think for us, we've always talked about when we quote unquote retire from these sort of full-time jobs, we want to have buy and invest in a small business. And we have a variety of different ideas. And partly it's because we both have run P&Ls and know how to manage people. We like that challenge of fixing it. And I'll tell you a really quick story, but I had a client, senior most executive at a Fortune 500 company, retires, and his wife wanted to buy a bookstore. And so they bought a local bookstore. Well, when you get that type of experience behind the little local bookstore, it was unbelievable to watch how their investment in buying this small business that was barely profitable when they bought it, they turned it into this money-making machine and eventually sold it and made a huge profit off of it. So for me, when I think about investing in businesses, I like the idea of the challenges of taking my experience of running bigger things and bringing something else to life. But it's all about your risk tolerance. I feel with doing it partnered with my husband, we would have a blast doing it as a couple. And we like doing this financial stuff as a couple, which is sort of geeky, but that's sort of how we roll.
I actually am on the same page with you. I personally just kind of enjoy it for the fun of it. I mean, obviously it's a challenge to do, but just the fact that you can participate in another business that you don't have to necessarily run. You know, I've done this in the past, invested in companies or other people are managing them. And I would act as the advisor because I had an expertise in a certain area and I would help and just, you know, give them some advice on certain investments, say, hey, you should look at this and, you know, why don't you look at that? And just really being there and just kind of helping them and giving them guidance. I mean, if they're running the business, but for me, it allowed me to kind of live vicariously through them without spending all of the necessary time that it takes to run a business. We get contacted a lot by people who are trying to buy a business inside their retirement account. You know, things like dry cleaners and other old school businesses that are, you know, good cash flowing businesses. To me, I find it very interesting because when you find somebody who's got a business entity that's just spinning out cash every year and they don't really have to do anything, it's really such a cool thing. And it's not like a publicly traded company. It's get your distributions every year and it's passive income, you know, if you invest in the right place. So I know a lot of people have been very successful. They've just been in the right place at the right time. One guy actually in New York, he owns a bunch of hotels and he just gets these enormous distributions every year. And he was not wealthy. He just happened to find the right person at the right time. And that person ended up doing really well. And I don't want to say it's a partnership, but there's a good kind of partner. I'll just use the word partnership there between them, where they kind of help each other out. So I think if you want to invest in private companies, there's a lot that you have to think about. And obviously no small part of that is making sure you invest in what you know and find something that you're enjoying doing as well as something that is lucrative. So want to kind of wrap it up here in the interest of time, but Barb, what about you? Final thoughts, and where can people find more about you?
Final thoughts are, it's always nice to have multiple streams of income. Regardless of what your primary source of income is, things happen. You can lose that. It can shift, whatever. So whenever you're investing, whenever you're working, it's always a good idea to determine, is there another way that I can have income coming in, whether it be from dividends, whether it be from investing in a partnership, whether it be from starting your own small business on the side when you have a full-time business. So my name is Barbara Friedberg, and you can find me at Robo Advisor Pros and Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance. Thanks for having me on, Kirk.
Thanks for coming on, Barb. Megan, what about you? Final thoughts, and where can people find more about you?
I find that there's always different ways to invest and maximize your money, but you really, the same tenets apply to all situations, which is do your due diligence, understand what you're getting into, and understand the risks. And as Barb said, I love, a variety of income streams. It really makes a huge difference. So I'm Megan Gorman. You can find me at thewealthintersection.com or at Wealth Intersect on Twitter. And thanks for having me on, Kirk.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Megan. So that's the show for this week. Thanks again for joining us, Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovate Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to our resources, show notes, and archive shows. We'll actually add a bunch of the resources here from our conversation here with Carl. I think there was a lot of great resources. We're going to add that to the show notes. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate to the show, it's going to allow us to get better access to some of the top guests that you're going to want to hear. We've got a bunch of great guests coming up. I think you're really going to love. So have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.